Good evening. Thank you, Madam President. As we are here talking about death, and death in very large numbers, I shall begin with prayer, which is this: may God be in my head and in my understanding. May God be in my heart and in my thinking. May God be in my mouth and in my speaking, and also in my ears and in my hearing, so that I listen to what the other side is saying as they do not listen to us. The first time I ever saw what a human head looks like after a bullet has passed through it was on a January night in Vilnius in Lithuania, when, as a reporter, I witnessed the KGB Alpha Group launching an attack upon an unarmed crowd of pro-independence Lithuanians. I cannot tell you now how furious and miserable I was at this sight, or how impressed I was at the courage of the Ukrainians who, while I lay down in the snow as the bullets whizzed around, stood up to this attack. I'd seen them earlier in the day standing up directly to Soviet Army troops. If anybody in this room cares to accuse me of being a Russian apologist, I'll see you outside and we can discuss it in detail there. But it is not true. For several months after that, while I was living in Moscow, I could barely speak to my Russian colleagues and acquaintances. I was so furious at this event. It is revolting what the Soviet Union did in those times and in those days. But the other thing is this: the following August, I had a chance to recover from it, because in August of 1991, that horrible, vicious, unspeakable, evil regime fell, and fell for good. I watched the Soviet Communist Party membership cards being burnt in every litter bin in central Moscow. I went down to Sevastopol and saw the Soviet Navy, which had been designed to dominate the world, scuttled and sunk in the creeks and inlets around that city. I knew it was over. And I have to tell you that in the time that followed, I became very hopeful that just possibly the great nation of Russia and its people would rise again out of this and become, as Poland has become, very remarkably, having been reduced in many ways to a similar level of servitude and brutality by Soviet rule, as Poland has become, that it could become prosperous and free and governed by law. And I've had to watch since then. I'd left Moscow long ago, but I have to watch since then fools, absolute fools on the Western side of the world, throwing away what was probably the best opportunity for European peace and permanent prosperity there has been in centuries, by making an enemy out of Russia when they had no need to do so. I'm not speaking about this on my own. I stand on the shoulders, particularly of George Kennan, the greatest diplomat of the 20th century, the master of the Cold War, the man who achieved the defeat of the Soviet Union through the policy of containment, who came out of retirement when the crazy policy of NATO expansion was brought forward by Bill Clinton, that shallow man, and approved without thought by a trivial Senate, which paid almost no attention to any serious arguments, but which had in fact been littered with money by arms manufacturers. This is true. This doesn't come from some left-wing rag. The New York Times investigated that vote and they found that arms manufacturers had spent £51 million trying to influence the Senate on the vote to allow the expansion of NATO. Just so you know, the dismal level of the debate that was taking place. This happened. Intelligent, wise people on our side said, do not do this. It will lead to a new Cold War. It will lead to a conflict. These people are not our enemies. These Russians are democrats and free people who've overthrown a tyranny. Why do we make an enemy of them? But the United States pursued that policy. And then we all like to say, yes, we love Russian liberals, Russian democrats. Well, here's one, Yegor Gaidar, one of the principal democratic Russians. He went round all his friends in all the NATO embassies in Moscow, begging them, saying, why is this? What is this that you're doing? Expanding NATO, driving a military alliance ever eastwards into a position where it will lead to conflict. And nobody paid any attention. And then the great hero of our time, the most brilliant diplomatist of our generation, George W. Bush, the architect of the Iraq War, he went to Bucharest to the NATO summit in 2008, a year after Vladimir Putin had gone to Munich, and said, what is this expansion for? What are you doing? Who is the enemy? And what did George W. Bush do? He said, we're going to expand NATO into Ukraine, although he had been advised by his own ambassador in Moscow and a future CIA chief not to do this. He browbeat Angela Merkel of the Federal Republic of Germany into supporting this ludicrous initiative, and lo and behold, conflict and bitterness spread into Ukraine. Now, when I was in Moscow in the time of the fall of the Soviet Union, of course I travelled down to Ukraine, and you could see perfectly well that here was a country full of people who longed to be free of Soviet power and were very glad to have it out of their lives. And for many, many years after this, it was a reasonably happy, reasonably prosperous, reasonably peaceful country. But once the NATO expansion spread towards it, once the idea became clear that it was to be used as a battering ram in some strange plan to create hostility where none existed, Ukraine began to divide between its east and its west, between those in Ukraine who were fervent nationalists of the old Western school and the people in the east who were more sympathetic to a close relation with Russia. And then there was an election in which a president, Viktor Yanukovych, was elected. And nobody disputes the result of this election. And that president was the one given the moment of decision. The European Union came and said, we're offering you an association agreement. And he said, actually, no thank you. It's not good enough. It will threaten the people in the East who voted for me. He wouldn't accept it. What happened to him? Do you know? You probably don't. He was overthrown by an armed mob in one of the most disgraceful undemocratic actions in modern European history. People who are rightly furious about Donald Trump's mob marching into the US Capitol when he lost the election don't even know what happened to Yanukovych. He was offering early elections, and yet the mob overthrew him. The Ukrainian parliament then met, broke all its own constitutional rules, and removed him. And from then on, Ukraine, instead of being the happy, reasonably prosperous, contented policy which had been before, and also the rather strikingly democratic policy in Eastern Europe, ceased to be so, and moved towards a civil war. You might think that any vote you have tonight won't have any effect. It won't really not have any effect. We are already at war with Russia. Are you not aware of this? Do you not know that Western special forces have been in Ukraine for many years? Do you not know the huge piles of weapons which we supply to Ukraine, which it couldn't possibly afford on its own account? Do you know that we help them target their missiles on Russia? Of course you do. And why is Ukraine being chosen for this particular job? Precisely, ladies and gentlemen, precisely, Madam President, because Ukraine is not in NATO. And therefore, the war can be pursued without any danger of it leading to a nuclear conflict. That is what is going on. The war is happening. And as for losing Ukraine, another small reminiscence, if I may. About 20 years ago, I went back to Moscow to see what was then the first military parade of the Russian armed forces since the end of the Soviet Union. And I watched it with my old friend Igor Monishev, whose father had been a Soviet Navy nuclear submarine captain who knew his stuff about military matters, and we watched all this stuff trundling by. And at the end of it, he turns to me and said, what do you think of our display of strategic scrap metal? And he was right. The Soviet Union may have been military powerful in its time, by its own standards. Russia is not a serious conventional military power. Its one aircraft carrier can't leave port without a tug in case it breaks down and seems to burn vegetable oil to move. Its navy is a comical display. Its army is drunken, ill-disciplined, and frankly disgraceful. And in 4 years of war, it hasn't been able to take Kharkov 20 miles from its border. And you think they're going to arrive at Calais? The European NATO states already spend, without any encouragement from Donald Trump, three times as much on armaments as Russia does. And they spend it better, and they have better armed forces. This is an imaginary threat. Why are we fighting this war? We're fighting this war because of a deep desire in certain American foreign policy circles to keep Russia down. And this is adumbrated in a document called the Wolfowitz Doctrine, which I urge you to look up, in which the whole idea was put forward that Russia could not be allowed to rise again. And this is the perfect expression of it. Look, I'm not here to engage in discussions about the virtue or vices of Ukraine. I'm not here to defend Russia. I'm actually here as a British patriot, somebody who loves this country and its people and doesn't want it to make a foolish mistake. I cannot for the life of me see, and I speak as someone, I have to say, whose daughter and son-in-law fought, well, in Afghanistan on the front lines, which Donald Trump said they stayed away from, whose father went in the Second World War on convoys to Murmansk carrying tanks to Joe Stalin, which wasn't his favorite activity in life, but it was necessary. I do come from a part of the country which believes in defense and war where it is necessary, and I will not be told that I'm not. Yes, of course.
North Korean soldiers have traveled 7,000 kilometers from North Korea to Kursk region in Russia just under a year ago.
Yep.
Iranian regime has assembled drones and gave them to Russia using Chinese technologies and resources. Mm-hmm. Why do British patriots such as you think that Britain must hide behind Ukrainians' back when all authoritarian regimes fight it?
I don't want to hide behind anybody. It's not... keep it up. Keep it up. It's not my war. I'm not hiding behind anybody. And I think it's extraordinarily rude and unpleasant of you to say that I am or that anybody else in this country is hiding behind anything. This country fights when it needs to. And it fights very hard, and it always has done. And I would strongly counsel against anybody thinking they could get away with attacking it in future. So I should keep that kind of sentiment largely to yourself most of the time if I were you. So I'm not hiding behind anything. I'm saying this is not a conflict in which this country has a stake. It is not a conflict based upon wisdom. It's a conflict based upon a particular view of a particular faction in American foreign policy circles into which we have no need to be drawn. And it is not there is no question of Ukraine being overwhelmed by this decrepit power. It isn't going to happen. You're being asked the wrong question. The question really is whether we should, as a country and as a people, be supporting this sort of diplomacy. Many of the people who are now urging you to get more and more engaged in the Ukrainian war are also the people who support the ridiculous war in Iran, which is destroying the world economy. They are very, very often the same people, and they come from the same stable, and you meet them all the time. War, war, war. They all want war, but none of them have seen it, and most of them would run from it very, very fast if they did. And for that reason, not because it'll make any difference, but for that reason, simply on the grounds of common sense, wisdom, and not being emotionalized into foolish war-making, I do strongly suggest, no more than strongly suggest, that you vote against this extremely silly motion. Thank you so much.